You're listening to the Social Work Me podcast with your hosts, Matt Barnes and Julie Carter.
You're listening to the Social Work Me podcast with your host, Matt Barnes, and this is episode 18, and we're almost hitting the one-year mark for the show, and I'm really excited to bring you another action-packed interview. Today I'm talking to Deborah Epstein, who is a former teacher, guidance counselor, who is now a registered psychotherapist in private practice in Toronto. And for over 20 years, Deborah has worked with children and adolescents in the school system. She has extensive experience working with middle school students and teens, and a lot of her career is focused on helping children and youth learn to problem solve effectively, to enhance their self-esteem, their confidence, and to help families. So we're covering a lot of ground over the next hour and a half, and we're focusing a lot on working with teens and their parents, and specifically those that are failing to launch. On a side note, if you like the show, follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook. If you want to give us a rating or a comment, we'd love to hear any feedback you have. And before we get to the show, just a quick word from our sponsors, Owl Practice. Are you thinking of opening a private practice? Or are you currently running a practice and feeling lost with how to organize your bookkeeping, your calendar, client list, case notes, appointment reminders? And there's so much going on when you're running a practice. Are you getting overwhelmed with no-shows, with last-minute cancellations? If this sounds like you, then it's probably time to check out Owl Practice. It's an online software that is essential for running a successful and efficient practice. All Social Work Me listeners will get their first month free with Owl, using the promo code SocialWorkMe. So head over to owlpractice.ca/socialworkme.php for all the details. This episode is brought to you by Rebel Office, an online resource center for entrepreneurs, including mentorship, strategy building, and graphic and web design services. To get in touch with Rebel Office about elevating your practice, visit rebeloffice.ca and let them know that the Social Work Me podcast sent you for all kinds of rebates and discounts. And finally, this podcast would not be possible without the support of Southwest Counseling Services in Sarnia, Ontario. All right, let's get to the show with our amazing guest, Deborah Epstein.
How does that make you feel?
Don't social work me.
I guess, first of all, it's great to talk to you, and you have a lot of experience working in the school system. And so I think it'll be really good to talk about teenagers and failure to launch, I guess, as maybe a main topic here, and the struggles with parents. Yeah. And it sounds like you really work with teens and parents and kids. But maybe could you just give us a little insight into how you got to where you're at and a bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. So I actually started my career as a teacher in an elementary school. I was teaching middle school English. Actually, I taught many middle school subjects, but that age group was mostly where my focus was. And as I was at that school for over 20 years, but as my, you know, as the years went on, I was finding that I was just more and more interested in like the gritty stuff, the stuff that kids were kind of going through, though I loved teaching English too. So then I started, I got my additional qualifications in guidance, and I kind of went that route a bit more, started to counsel kids a bit more, became the dean of students there. So then I was responsible for sort of the social and mental well-being of the entire school. And I did that for a number of years. And then I was like, it's time for me to, I really want to do the really gritty work. So I went back to school in my mid-30s and got my master's, and then started a private practice after that.
Wow.
And continued to work in the school. And then once my private practice was really rolling, I left the school.
Nice. And this is all in Toronto?
All in Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm always curious around, because I think one of the biggest struggles sometimes working with schools, and I guess this is maybe sort of relates back to my time working at Children's Aid and collaborating with teachers and school staff, is sometimes there's a lack of understanding of trauma in the school system and a real focus on behaviors.
100%.
Did you found that as well?
Yeah, 100%. It was actually one of my goals as the dean. I was really gifted by my administration. I was in an independent school, so we had some wiggle room around what we could do. And I developed a social emotional learning curriculum school wide to really help both students, obviously, gain the skills they needed around managing and coping and all of those things, and really talking about emotion. Because they don't do that at school. But that also obviously gifted teachers with the ability to kind of look at students in a really different kind of way. But yeah, I think that's a serious problem. And frankly, some of that is just there's not enough support for teachers, right? They have to do so much in a day. Mm-hmm. That like having to, they can only kind of, I think, cope with and deal with what's in front of them. Obviously kind of looking at it and understanding where it's coming from is incredibly helpful and kind of guides how they, you know, how they manage things. But I think there's not enough support, I think, for teachers to be able to like manage all of that. But I agree with you 100%. Yeah. Often they just look at behavior and they don't really understand where it might be.
Yeah. And I don't know the stats at this time, but I've had some conversations with teachers around the number of students that are on IEPs now being like close to a quarter of students.
Yeah.
So you've got maybe 5, 6 to maybe 10 kids in your class. Well, that might be a bit much, but you know, a good chunk of kids that have individual education plans that you're focused on that and then trying to teach and sometimes having split grades. And so there's a lot of challenges in that school system.
Yeah. Lots of moving parts. Right. So yeah, they have to manage all of it. So it's not an easy job. Having done it, I can tell you it's not an easy job. And I think, and harder now, I think, because the number of kids who come into school, never mind IEPs, there's lots of kids who also come in with lots of anxiety. When I started my career, that did not, it might have existed, certainly never saw it. And if it happened, it was so rare. We would go on these field trips. You know, our grade sixes would go on a 3-night overnight. And at the beginning of my career, it was like, yeah, of course everybody's going. And by the end of like the time that I left, we'd have easily, I'd say probably 20% who wouldn't go at all. Wow. They couldn't leave home. They were too anxious.
What do you make of that?
I mean, I think a lot of it is anxiety. Kids who just from a very young age were not, I guess, supported really the way they needed to be. So by the time they're, you know, in grade six and they're 12 years old, you know, many of them have never slipped out of their homes, haven't, can't just feel like they really can't manage it. I think I hate to blame social media, but I do think it absolutely plays a role that didn't exist when I started my career. I know I just aged myself, but it didn't exist. It wasn't a factor. And now I think it plays such a huge role, especially for, you know, young teens, well, even older teens, but you know, that time frame especially. So, you know, around the judgment piece of it and all of that, they just they just don't have the coping skills that they did. Mm-hmm. And I think also in fairness to them, I think, and I don't mean to blame parents here, but I think some of that behavior gets accommodated by parents. And so instead of helping kids sort of push through that and become more resilient around it and gain sort of coping strategies around, you know, what do I do if I'm feeling anxious that you're not with me? They just accommodate it. And so it just becomes more ingrained and harder for kids to kind of do things on their own.
That makes a lot of sense. I was just reading just a research article about kind of failure to launch, and the University of Michigan did this national study where they interviewed parents, and they found that 25% of parents admitted that they are the main reason why their teenagers haven't launched or aren't prepared to be adults. And a lot of it kind of came down to, it's a lot of time and energy to build independence in our kids and giving them more responsibilities. And a lot of parents in that study said, it's just quicker and easier for me to do the chores or for me to cook dinner or, right? So I guess part of this goes back to time and how busy we are and the rat race of the world.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of factors.
Yeah. I think about that sometimes because that is becoming a larger and larger piece of my practice. And what I continue to see, it's a real mixture of things. That piece for sure with parents who, whether it's guilt around not being home enough or it's just faster if I just do it myself, for them. So, it doesn't even occur. I think failure plays a huge role, both watching their kids' failure, like the potential of their kid to, and failure could be like tying their shoe, like not being able to tie their shoes to something bigger, like not making a sports team, to, something even bigger than that, not getting into university, for example. But they can't tolerate it. The parents can't tolerate it. So they protect them. There's that piece of it. And also I think that reflects on parents' own sense of failure, right? If my kid fails, what does that say about me? So I think there's a huge struggle there and such a balance between which part is, I'm not sure which part plays a bigger role, but I think they both sort of, play a role with each other. And so that makes it worse. So parents like are very quick to save their kids, whether it's tying their shoes or whether it's, getting into an argument with the coach because their kid didn't make it, or whether it's, writing. I was TAing at U of T for a CBT course, and we had people who would have parents get involved in those. It's crazy town. Anyway, so, I think that piece. So there's that. I think there's often what I'm noticing, and I don't think it always happens, but there's some form of sort of younger childhood trauma, I would say, whether it's like bullying or some, major event that happened in their lives, as, it could be abuse in the home. It could be a number of things, but and often bullying, that kids get sort of stuck with this idea that like, I'm not good enough, which sort of gets perpetuated by the family support unit, because, then they're doing things for you. So you learn like, oh, I'm not good enough. And look, like my parents have to make my breakfast for me, or they have to speak to my coach in order for me to make the team. So it like perpetuates the cycle that they're not good enough. Mm. So I think, that sort of, what I kind of notice. And then also like just with the not failing means that you don't get opportunity to learn how to be resilient. So they literally have, when they talk about coping with things, mm-hmm. they avoid. Like, it's just inevitable that these kids who aren't launching are kids who are, when faced with tasks, and again, they could be really small things, or they could be really big things, but they just avoid them because it just feels too big. So they just stop doing them completely.
That's a good point. It's like the not being able to tolerate painful emotions, I guess. Shame, failure. And I think, it was interesting a couple years ago, I remember that they started, at least where I lived in near London, stopped keeping the score of kids' soccer games. And so kids are playing games and no one's winning or losing. And so they're not really learning how to cope with loss, how to cope with failing. And I think a lot of that came out of issues with parents being too competitive, maybe putting a lot of pressure on their kids. Maybe it came from a place of wanting to protect kids from that, but I think it did a disservice, and they ended up keeping score anyways, just on the sidelines. But yeah, this kind of idea that we protect our kids from failing, but maybe it's really we're protecting ourselves from experiencing that emotion of our kids struggling or being in pain or
Yes, agreed. Yeah, and I also think that parents who talk about that really talk about like the how much it hurts. It's a visceral response for them to like watch their kids cry, right? Or experience pain in that kind of way.
I guess it's a primitive piece of that, like a protective part as a parent that you want to, you know, keep your kids safe. But I guess what you're kind of saying is maybe this comes back to the parents' own past, their own trauma, their own bullying maybe, or failure.
Yeah, I think that comes up a lot for sure. I don't want my kid to experience what I experienced. And that could be, you know, as strong as bullying, but it also could be, you know, my parents were too authoritarian. I don't want that for my kids. There wasn't enough, you know, love in my home, which is also obviously trauma. But yeah, so that they go like
the other way
to the extreme. You know, I don't want to do that for my kids, so I'm going to do something really different. There is a happy medium, but sometimes people really struggle to find it. And I also think it's parents feeling like at a real loss. Like, I actually don't know how to handle this. So if I just fix it, that I can do, right? I know how to problem solve. I know how to fix it. So I'll just fix it because I don't know what else to do. So it's like very interesting. And then I find what happens with parents is, and this is the other piece, is that the relationship with their kids, particularly when they get to their teens, become like older teens, like into sort of young adulthood, is that the relationship, I always end up asking the question, so how instructional is your relationship with your child? How much of your interaction with them is instructional? And inevitably, what I often get with kids who are really struggling to launch is that the parents will admit that the relationship is like, they'll say 90%, 85%, like really high. And that's their only interaction with their kids. Pick up your clothes, you know, do the dishes in the sink. Have you signed up for your courses? What are you doing about the car? All of those kinds of things. Not real conversations with their kids, not real connection. So I think that plays a factor too.
Wow, that's interesting. So it's kind of like the relationship is all about tasks and chores, but it's the parents reminding them, telling them all the time. So why would I need to think about it if my mom is going to just remind me 50
minutes? Totally. 100%. And it just causes like tumult, right? Because then you're reminding your kids 7,000 times to, you know, do the dishes in the sink. They are so fed up with hearing you like natter on about the instruction. So I always say, you know, the tighter the leash, the harder they pull. Like you're just, you get this, and it's the perfect storm for just nobody getting anything done. So one of the first things I sort of work on with parents when I'm working with them around failure to launch is like, how do we change your relationship from like correct to connect? Like you need to connect first. And then you can work on correction, but you certainly cannot, especially not with a young adult. If you think you're going to get anywhere with just, you know, pick up this and do that, they lose it on you, like, or they just shut down. They kind of stop listening. Which I totally get. I wouldn't want someone nattering at me all the time either. So, but it's hard as a parent to not remind your kids 7,000 times to do something when they're still sitting there and they haven't done it. So I get it. I get why that happens.
Yeah, and I guess it's tiring being a parent, and you get burnt out, and the other things that you're managing in life, your job or other relationships, the house. Sometimes these things take a backseat, and kind of like that study, you know, it's just easier if I do it. I'll do the laundry, I'll cut the grass, I'll make the beds, rather than nattering 15 times, like you said, and draining.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, you know, there's kind of, let's talk a bit about your private practice, because I'm interested in how you structure your sessions. And I imagine like a lot of us, sometimes referrals come in from parents. It's like, here's all my kids' problems, fix them kind of thing.
Yes.
I don't want to do any work. You know, I think we talked a bit before, you know, today around kind of an archetype client, or, you know, a typical failure to launch teenager who's, you know, and especially now with COVID, this really complicates so much around routine and structure. You know, the teenager that's unmotivated, that's you know, maybe smoking a lot of weed or drinking, playing video games, staying up all hours of the night, sleeping all day. And then the parents now are getting frustrated and are kind of realizing, like, we got school in about 6 weeks. We need to start turning this around. So I'm sure you're probably getting more and more referrals of these, I guess, the standard kind of failure to launch teen.
Yeah.
What do you, can you walk us through kind of what do you do from when you get the referral to, you know, how do you structure your sessions? What approach do you use? Things like that.
So you're right. Some, I will often get phone calls from parents who will say, these are the issues, you know, that I have with my kid. Can you see them? And when I started my practice, I was, I think, more concerned about how parents were going to respond when I said to them, like, part of this work has to be with you. So I was, you know, a bit more careful. And now when people call, I'm just like, this is how this goes. Even though you have a young adult, they're not living in a bubble. And part of the issue is like the dynamic that's happening in your home. So like this has to be family work, which is what I tell the kids too. For the most part, and I actually find this shocking, particularly with young adults, because you would expect a 19 or 20 year old to be like, hells no, I don't want my parent, I want nothing to do with this discussion with my parents. But I actually don't find, and I can't explain why. I guess maybe there's a part of them that really wants it to change. That's the only reason really I can think of, because they are actually exposing themselves to pain and change in the dynamic, which, you know, feels comfortable. It's working for them in some ways, I think, but I think they recognize maybe that in other ways it's not. So inevitably, you know, and if that doesn't work for them, I tend to just say, I'm not your gal. Cause I find it doesn't work. When you're only working, frankly, with one or the other. And if you had to only work with one or the other, I would say to parents, I am much better off working with you than I am your kid. Even though it looks like the kid is experiencing most of the issues, they are, but I find most of the time if the parents change sort of what's happening for them, and the dynamic that's happening at home, kids tend to do better, even if they don't do the work. But for the most part, I find everyone's sort of willing to participate in it. And I often sort of do individual work with kids at the same time as sort of working with parents, and I sort of bring them together and then see them individually and bring them together and see them individually. I never sort of pull punches around. Like if I'm saying one thing to parents, I'm always really open with the kids about what I'm saying. Like I don't do anything behind other people's backs. It's very sort of forthright and out in the open. But sometimes I just find saying certain things to parents, it's very hard to sort of say to a parent, you know, when you do this, you're accommodating this behavior, for example, or, you know, you're giving them a really easy way out and you need to be tougher. So saying that in front of a kid sort of just undermines parents, and I don't ever want to do that. So that kind of work I would do with the parents and sort of explore what gets in the way, for example, for them. Why did they think they're making the choices? What's working? What isn't? You know, can we come up with a different way to maybe manage that? So often I will do that, not with kids in attendance, just because I don't want them to feel berated in front of their kids. Not that I'm berating them at all, but I mean, it is about a change, and I don't want kids to sort of have judgment about that, but they also know what's happening. So that's how I tend to sort of do the work from the get-go. It's like, I strongly recommend doing it from a family system sort of perspective. And I find that works best.
And I guess, like you were saying, as a new therapist, initially feeling like I can't tell parents that they have to do the work, there's a bit of fear, like they're the stakeholder, they're the ones paying. I don't want to put that onus on them. But then over time, you just realized it's ineffective without, I guess.
Yeah, I just, at the beginning, I think it's also, to be totally honest, it's about, it means you're not going to get a client necessarily, right? And when you're just starting to build a private practice, every client matters. Not that they don't all matter all the time, but I mean, in terms of the financial piece of it, it matters if they turn around and leave. And so I think that for sure was driving my behavior easily in the first 6 months of opening my practice. And then I just first of all, I think, you know, I think with the numbers as they grew, I was like, okay, like I'm in an okay place now that if I don't get this client, it's going to be okay. But even more so, it's like, I can't do, like nothing changes. Mm-hmm. And that's so brutal as a therapist to like sit there and be like, all right, well, like it's not any different now than it was 6 months ago. Like that's not a good thing. So yeah. I think that also sort of was a driving factor for me. It was like, I'm going to be much more successful with families if everybody's playing a role. So
nice. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I think one of the, and you kind of touched on it, like this balance of who's my client. You know, sometimes when we start working with teens and, you know, maybe it comes in as they want to do the work, but I think a lot of times with failure to launch, it's like the thing, like you said, it's like things are kind of working for them in some ways, yeah. Getting, you know, their wants met, not always their needs. But so can you talk a little bit about buy-in? Because I think sometimes that's hard with teenagers to come in, especially when they're way out of routine. They're, you know, we talked about, you know, the drinking, smoking, playing video games, unmotivated, not working. Mom and dad are doing everything for them. You know, I've had clients that their parents bribe them to come in, you know, like I'll buy you a new pair of shoes or you get to go for dinner after. That's not ideal.
No.
How do you get these teenagers to kind of buy into the process of changing, of participating in therapy?
It's a good question. I work a lot on relationship building at the beginning. So, and I warn parents, like if you ask your parent, your kid, and I don't bring parents in until it, I don't know, you reach sort of a threshold where it's like, all right, all of these things that keep coming up often have to do with your parents. Like maybe now's a good time to sort of bring them in. So I'm always up front at the beginning that will likely be a piece, but I never start with it. So I always start with relationship building with the teen first. And so that's just about really just spending time getting to know them. I don't worry about the presenting issues. I don't ask questions about, unless I really feel like we've already connected, but I don't ask questions about like what's going on at home or, you know, what's relationship like with your parent, like any of that. I really just spend time, and I warn parents, I'm like, you know, if your kid comes home and tells you that we talked about football for an hour, like they're being honest with you. That's what we talked about. Cause it's all about just, you know, connecting. That tends to make a huge difference. Not surprising to any therapist that, you know, therapeutic rapport is, you know, alliance is, you know, of the utmost. And I think, yeah, that's how I tend to get buy-in. And frankly, sometimes I don't. Like I'm not, you know, I'm certainly not perfect by any stretch. And sometimes I don't get buy-in from kids. They're not interested in the change. I mean, why would they be, right? You know, mm-hmm. If that means now I have to have a routine and now my parents are actually going to follow through when they lay down an expectation. And now like some of them just don't want that, understandably so. So sometimes I don't. And if that happens, I tend to just work with parents.
Well, I like that you give the parents a bit of a disclaimer that, you know, these first sessions, we might not be getting to the nitty gritty. And I think as new therapists, often we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to be accomplishing a lot right off the hop. And I know I admittedly early days would jump right into, okay, let's start getting to work here before really having that relationship developed. And
yeah,
well, we know how that goes.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember going to my supervisor sort of in the early days and being like, you know, all we've talked about is like, you know, what she likes to do and who her friend group is and all of that. And I was like, and I know like it's been four sessions and like, we haven't even talked about what's happened. And my supervisor was like, so, and I was like, well, don't I need to, she was like, just, you got time. I was like, all right. But it does make a really big difference. I think, you know, you get obviously much further when they trust you.
Yeah. And the trust is complicated because you are going to be working with their parents at some point. And, you know, yesterday I had this situation. I'm working with a teenager and his dad comes in at the end of the session to book the next appointment. And he's like, so Matt, I hear that you think that my rules are too strict at home. And I had never given an opinion on the rules at home. So clearly this teenager is kind of using me as support for him to have looser rules. But then you're kind of caught, you know, maybe I haven't gotten to the point of doing the parent work yet, where my alliance is with the teenager. So there's a confidentiality piece. There's trust that we're building. It's early days. How do you manage that?
I'm really forthright always. Cause I feel like that's the best way to sort of protect everyone. Frankly, it's like, I'm never going to, so then I never have to doubt like, wait, did I say that? Cause it's like, yeah, no, I did. Cause I'm always going to be really upfront with you. So, from the beginning, I always tell parents, like, you need to understand, though I'm working with you too, that your child is my client. And so when push comes to shove, like, that's where sort of my loyalties lie. Not to say necessarily that I'm going to agree with the kid. Like, that's not where the loyalty is. It's just about, again, protecting sort of, you know, their confidentiality, making sure that I'm not, especially as I'm about to bring parents in, I probably go over what I'm going to be sharing with, if the kid's not going to be in the room, I probably go over it at least two or three times over like two or three sessions with the kids about, all right, let me just make sure that I'm clear. This is what I've written down about what I'm talking about them. Let's make sure there's nothing that like I'm, you know, is there anything specific that you don't want me to share with your parents? And yeah. And when they say it, I write it down. I make sure that I, you know, that I never cross that, but we go over it a number of times so that the kids feel like, okay, she's got my back. She's not going to overstep. This is what she's going to focus on. I mean, ideally I like to bring them together, but sometimes kids don't want that. They want me to say what I believe should be said, or, you know, give parents guidance around whatever it is, but not in their presence.
Interesting.
It's just uncomfortable. So, I just make sure I review it a number of times before it actually happens, so kids feel like, okay, she gets it, and I trust that she's going to handle this the way she's now said it three times, like the same way, even though that feels repetitive. I think it actually feels also like
that's trust building.
I get that, and trust building, exactly. So
really, you're maintaining the child or the teen as your focus in terms of the trust and the therapeutic alliance, and then getting permission to share things. And then hopefully eventually when you have that relationship, bringing the parents in.
Yeah. But I'll also be really upfront with kids. Like if I notice, for example, I find this happens a lot with kids who are struggling with failure to launch, is they're tantruming. Their behavior will look like, I mean, it looks like much bigger, a bit scarier because they're, well, not a bit scarier, probably a lot scarier because they're, you know, adults or young adults anyway. But their behavior, when you really look at it, in some ways is like tantruming. Well, if one of the expectations, for example, is that kids get chores done before they get on the internet and spend their hours doing, gaming, that they, when they don't follow through, for example, their parents will like shut off their internet, and the like explosion that then ensues because the kids aren't getting sort of what they want is really just a larger version of what it would have looked like when they were toddlers and didn't get to play with the toy or it was bath time or whatever it is. So I think I'm quite upfront about like, you understand that when you had that explosion, like that was a bit of a tantrum on your part. Right? Because you were upset that I validate it. Like you were really upset that your parents turned off your internet and you were in the middle of a game and you were excited to see your friends. I'm totally, you know, validating your experience of that. I'm also going to point out to you that your response was a tantrum. Like you don't have any other way right now to cope with your experience of not getting what you wanted because growing up, that was your experience. Like you tantrumed and then your parents gave you kind of what you wanted, or you were sad and your parents gave you what you wanted because they didn't want to see you. So it didn't necessarily have to be a tantrum, but they learn, right? That when they're sad, their parents are going to do things for them. And so it just becomes an ingrained part of their response. So, but I'll say, I just want you to know, like when I speak to your parents, I'm going to address this with them. So, you know, they know it's coming.
And I guess you're talking about consequencing, emotional regulation. You know, it seems like in terms of carrots, like Wi-Fi is the biggest deal these days. What's your advice to parents or recommendations, or do you weigh in on consequencing and kind of behavior management, I guess would be the old school way of looking at it? Or do you come at it from a different direction?
I do. What I tend to talk about is you can't really set an expectation without having a consequence for not meeting it. So I sort of just talk about even sort of life expectations and consequences that ensue, right? And that could be both positive and negative. If I have a report to hand in at work, if I don't get my report in on time, my boss is going to reprimand me in some way, shape, or form, right? They're going to say, Deborah, what's up? They might just say, Deborah, what's up? They might say, Deborah, you're on probation. I don't know what they're going to do, but there's going to be some form of consequence. If I give you a gift, you're going to be really happy. And that's the consequence for me giving you the gift. Yay. Like you say, yay, I love this gift. And I feel good and you feel good. So I really talk about sort of if you're setting an expectation, you need to know what the consequence for not meeting it is. And then you need to be consistent with whatever that looks like. So I tend to approach it from that direction. So it's definitely behavioral. But it also, I think, is helpful in kind of giving parents a way to look at how they've managed things up until that point and have they followed through or haven't they. So it's much more, I think, about sort of parent support rather than sort of kid support around that piece of it. But also I think it encourages dialogue, because what I tend to do, especially with young adults, is, but frankly, even from early teens, I encourage parents to have conversations with their kids about what it all looks like, and really talk about it from an emotional standpoint. I find I get really frustrated when I have to ask you 7,000 times to do the same thing. So I don't want to participate in that dynamic with you anymore. So let's really talk about, you know, what's getting in the way. You know, what do I need to do as a parent? Do I need to just tell myself, I know I want the dishes washed right now, but the truth is if they get washed in 10 minutes from now, that's really fine. But also have the kids say, you know, this needs to happen. So you tell me what you think is fair if this doesn't happen. Because I need to know, right? If I expect that you're going to be up at 10 and you're not up at 10, what's supposed to happen? Because I don't want to come into your room every day and say, get up, you're supposed to be up. Why aren't you up yet? And like get into that with you. And you're like rolling your eyes. I can hear you rolling your eyes at me and it's brutal. And I'm not interested in this sort of dynamic with you. So you tell me what you think should happen. So like it encourages a dialogue between everybody. Which to me is much more about connecting than correcting, right? This is my experience of you. This is your experience of me. Let's really talk about how we can change this dynamic. Oh, okay. You think I should, I don't know, whatever, turn off your internet, or you think I should, I don't know, whatever. You need to set an alarm to make sure that you're up, or you need to make sure you're going to bed earlier because getting up at 10 is really hard for you right now. Let's just talk about all of that, but you tell me what should happen if you're not up at 10. And usually teens are really good about saying, I think this should happen. And then of course, when they participate in that discussion, they have ownership for it. So then it's easy.
Yeah, I like that. And it sounds like everyone having an opportunity to talk about expectations, maybe parents recalibrating them a little bit or looking at what's appropriate now or what's realistic, getting some buy-in from their kids in terms of consequences. But you also talked about parents expressing their emotions, which I think a lot of parents struggle with. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. That is actually something I find I talk about a lot with parents. And that's from young, like from young age. Somewhere along the line, I don't know who taught this lesson, I don't know where it came from, that parents are not supposed to share emotions at all. I had a parent who was talking to me about they were struggling with about to be their own parent was unwell, And they were really struggling with that, but they felt that they couldn't share that with their kids. So they were like, I can't cry in front of my kid. And I was like, why can't you cry in front of your kid? Like, you're about to lose your parent. Why can't your child know that that's really painful for you and really difficult for you? Oh, well, they should know that I'm in charge and I have it all together. I do believe there's a part of that. Yes, kids should feel that their parents are sort of sitting on their own thrones, wearing the crowns in the household and running it and can manage it for sure. But that doesn't mean emotion should then be totally tossed out the window, because that, I think ultimately it gets viewed as weakness, right? If you show emotion, you're weak. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, you know, a bit of a societal influence, but I don't buy into that at all. I think actually parents showing emotion is strength, not weakness. And frankly, like just being able to say, I'm really sad that my parent is going to die in a few months or whatever, it is incredibly important. Because otherwise, what are you modeling for your kids about what they're allowed to show and what they're not? So I really encourage parents to talk about how they feel to a point. You know, I got in a fight with your father and now I'm devastated. It's not appropriate. But certainly I'm sad that my parent is dying. It's very appropriate. So I think, but also just saying, I'm really frustrated today. I've got this, don't worry about it. But I'm frustrated. So I need to go for a walk right now is an amazing way to model for your kids that you have emotions and that you know how to cope with them. And that you have strategies to cope with them on top of it. But I think one of the reasons also, parents that lack of connection happens because parents are afraid to talk about what their experience of something is, right? I was really hurt when you came in and you didn't say hello to me and you just scoffed at me. That's hurtful. When a teen acts like that, and I don't think there's anything wrong. And I think it's actually really important to understand their parents aren't just like these people who are supposed to provide them with everything, do whatever they want, meet all of their wants and needs and then not have feelings. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think it's really, really important.
So it sounds like you kind of educate them and give them space to start to understand their emotions and then expressing them to their children.
Yeah. I do a lot of emotion focused family therapy work when I tend to, like, that's the model I often use. So that parents sort of learn to validate their kids' emotions without necessarily agreeing with them, but at least they learn how to sort of validate and talk about emotion, which often is left out of the picture completely. Mm-hmm. And also helps parents sort of understand that sometimes what we see isn't what's actually happening underneath, particularly for their kids. So, you know, it looks like anger, but it might actually be something completely different. It might be anxiety, for example. So it presents as like really angry and defensive, but actually they're really struggling underneath it. So when we kind of dive into that, I think it helps drive parents' own behavior and their own ways of sort of managing. You would handle something really differently if you knew your kid was anxious, for example, than you would if they were angry.
And I think a lot of parents don't know that, and I guess this is something we learn through emotion-focused training, is that recognizing, even naming an emotion, is the first step in problem solving.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I read that a lot. If you can name it, you can tame it.
And I think, like you said, there's a lot of parents that feel like, if I tell my kid how I'm feeling, I'm burdening them, or I'm, you know, putting extra pressure on them or weight that they might not be able to manage. Mm-hmm. But really, like you said, it's teaching them that they're not a vacuum that just can suck up all the, you know, the abuse or the bickering or lack of follow through or whatever it is, and just carry on with their day, that this has an impact on them too.
Mm-hmm. And it impacts the relationship, and it's allowed to impact the relationship. In what world are you allowed to act like no matter what you do doesn't matter? It does matter, even with your parents or even with your siblings. I find that happens a lot too, right? Siblings, the parents will talk about how the behavior of the kid who's kind of struggling or who's my client is impacting their siblings. And it's often like this tornado of, you know, a kid who kind of kind of does and says what they want, with lots of impact on often the younger sibling. And parents don't know how to manage that piece of it either. They're just like, I don't know what to do because he's so rude to his younger brother, or he's so whatever, or she's so snippy with her, whatever it is. But yeah, I find that plays a role too. So I think if everyone is just a bit more entitled to their emotional experience, you know, they complain, for example, that their kids have no empathy. And I often will say, so how often are you talking about how their behavior impacts you, what that's like for you? And they're like, I never talk about that. How can they have empathy with you if, like, you don't teach them that you actually have feelings about that? Like, so you'd be better off saying, what do you think this experience is like for me? Right? How do you think this makes me feel?
And that's great buy-in for parents who, I mean, just that alone, that what you just said about empathy, you're actually withholding their development of empathy.
Yeah. And their permission that it almost feels like, not that they need my permission, but it does, I think, feel like permission for them when it's like, I encourage you. Like, I think it's really important for you to talk about, like, what you just shared with me in terms of how you feel. What stops you from sharing that with your kid? And after, like, oh, I never thought that was appropriate. Blah, blah, I'm like, let's see what happens if you try that. Like, what do you think might happen? The relief, I think, that parents feel like, wow, I can actually share this with my kid and that's okay. That doesn't make me like the worst parent in the world. I think that is one of the parents are so concerned about how they might be perceived by their kids, and of not doing a good job. And I think, you know, intergenerational trauma sort of leads into that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it really informs a lot of people's decisions around what they choose to do. As parents. So
just you validating it, normalizing it, promoting it gives them that room to grow and to change that dynamic.
Yeah.
It really speaks to how much we love our kids and how much we want them to do the best they can. But sometimes our own stuff gets in the way and the pressure we put on ourselves can be suffocating.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that plays a huge role in it. So I think when you just reassure parents, like, wow, how lucky your kid is that they have you because of all of these things that you're providing, and you sort of point out for them all the really great things they're doing. It, again, it's like, it's such a relief. It's just like, oh, okay. Thanks.
And I think
you brought like, up, oh, so hard I'm working.
You brought up empathy and, you know, how hard parents work, I think, around problem solving with their kids. And so what do you do? Like there's some connection, I guess, with problem solving and then with just being empathetic. How do you talk to parents about that? Or how do you help them with that piece?
Yeah. The EFFT model, that Adele France sort of, created is amazing because it actually comes, she has this, like, she's created a script that I often work on with parents. But the most important aspect of it is that it's a 3-step process. And that is that you always begin with validation. And Adele France talks about, like, always giving 3 becauses for whatever it is that you sort of take a stab at, like, I would imagine that you're feeling, you know, fill in the blank because. And so parents learn to sort of validate, to be empathic, to really put themselves in their kid's shoes and try and figure out, like, how is this kid feeling and why? Why are they feeling like that? Well, I'm going to take a stab at what the whys are with these 3 becauses. And so we really work on, like, that validation language, and still understanding you can validate without agreeing, because that is a big struggle for parents. It's like, well, I don't, what he's saying is ridiculous. I'm like, but that's how he feels right now. So you don't have to agree with it. You'll notice, like, when you say, I would imagine that you're feeling frustrated because, like, none of those things are, I totally agree with you. They're not. You're really validating how your kid feels. And then they're like, oh, my parent gets it. So then, like, the next piece of that is sort of the emotional support. And so that can look like, you know, a touch on the shoulder. It can be sort of radical non-judgment. Like, I totally, totally get why you feel like that. It could be, an idea of sort of togetherness, like, I get that, and you're not alone in it, and we're going to get through this together, like those kinds of things. You know, a hug, it could be any number of things in terms of emotional support. So we talk about what that potentially looks like, and then we talk about problem solving. So you can't do those, the problem solving piece, without those first two pieces first. That's how the model sort of works. And so that's what I work on with parents. So deep, deep validation. And we work on that for quite some time. They'll take an issue, they'll work on it, they'll come back the following week, and we'll sort of look at like what gets in the way. Inevitably, what gets in the way is often parental inability to control their own emotions before they have a conversation with their kids. So if they're kind of dysregulated, and talking to a kid who's dysregulated, they just both, you know, neurons that fire together. So they're wired together up here. And so if parents can't sort of calm themselves down first, they'll always say like, I couldn't de-escalate it. No matter what I said, didn't bring it down. I was like, what was your mood at the time? Well, I was really angry. I'm like, okay, then you would have been better off like stepping away from that conversation first, calming yourself down, and then trying to have a conversation where you're validating your kid. Because if you're screaming at them, I understand why you might feel because it doesn't work. So yeah, so that's how I tend to work on the model.
I love that. I love the three-step approach. It kind of reminds me of Bruce Perry's model, the Bruce Perry model, regulate, relate, reason.
Yeah.
Sort of the same thing, but I like the because.
Yeah.
It really, it forces the parent to put themselves in their kids' shoes.
Totally. And I have to say, yeah, when they come back, inevitably they're like, oh my God, I can't believe that worked. It always works. I'm like, try it with your spouse. It really works. It does. It really does make people feel, because what I often will talk about is that when kids feel really unheard or unseen, I mean, this is anybody, not just kids, but when we feel unheard or unseen, there's nothing worse than just sort of feeling invisible. But if your parent can connect with you on a level where you actually feel like they get it, especially when there are places where, like, I'll admit there are simply places I just don't get it. I never thought I'd be one of those parents who's just like, that is a total generational gap. I don't understand what you're saying to me right now, especially around like labels and relationships. Like, no labels. I'm like, okay, I don't get that, but okay, I'll roll with it. But so many kids talk about it, but it's, you know, there are certainly things I think, you know, from a or music, whatever, there are definitely things generationally that I think, you know, cause us to not understand each other. So if we can, you know, at least overcome the places where it actually is easier to get in. And I think, you know, emotion is pretty universal. So I think if you can really put yourself and really try to understand what your kid's experience of something is, it's a game changer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because then also you're looking at the emotion that's driving their behavior, and you're not spending so much time looking at the behavior. I talk a lot about that, you know, the majority of our behavior is driven by how we feel. So if you can sort of be a detective, like an emotional detective, and try and figure out what it is that your kid was feeling to make them do what they did, which you think, which is obviously, you know, the part that you're so focused on, because it's what you see, right? You don't see the emotional part. And often kids don't walk around like giving you a map. This is how I feel now. This is how I feel now. Like, they just don't do that. It would be so much easier if they did, but they don't. So, you know, all you have to go on is the behavior. But if you can sort of force yourself to really think about why they did what they did, what emotion was driving it, yeah. I think you manage it differently.
So this kind of all connects back to the school system, I guess, and the idea of looking past the behavior, that the behavior is just a language. Right. And there's emotions.
Just a symptom. Yeah. I mean, really, you know, poor negative behavior that you don't want to see is really just a symptom. And you know, to go back to that, teachers, when they recognize, oh my God, this is what this kid's experience is, because all I needed to do was like ask the right question. And it all just like came to me. Like, I mean, sometimes it's that easy, sometimes it's not. They feel so bad. Because I mean, teachers go in, you know, they don't go in much to you know, the opposition of what some people say about teachers going into teaching because of their summer holidays. They really go into teaching because they love kids and they want to teach. They want to, you know, contribute in that kind of way. So usually I would say, you know, in my experience, 95% of the people that I worked with were really there for absolutely the right reasons. And so it's just not, it's not necessarily a skill set of teachers, right? They're not counselors. They're not therapists. They weren't trained in that, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. And yeah. I think one of the things that we see a lot now is self-esteem, self-confidence issues with teenagers, which is really connected to the failure to launch. What do you do with teens or with families around those issues, like trying to increase confidence and self-esteem?
Yeah, that that part is so difficult. Especially, again, you know, if you're working with a young adult, their experiences up until that point, often in my experience of them, is that, you know, there's been so much, again, like sort of trauma or just really difficult times for them, that like it's so ingrained that they're, you know, they feel like garbage. They just feel like there's nothing good about them. I was working with one young adult, and I often will ask kids what they like about themselves. And sometimes I need to actually like sort of go through that process where like, we'll play a game. It's like, all right, let's go back and forth. Just name something that you like about yourself. And I do it with them because it's like, they feel, especially girls, feel like they're bragging, which is not something they have been raised to do. They're supposed to be, you know, full of humility and graciousness and not talk about how great they are. So we go back and forth just talking about the things that make us great. And this one young adult, I was like, can we come up with a list of 10? And he could not, which was gut-wrenching to sort of have a kid. I was like, let's start with, you know, 3. Even that was a struggle for him. But as I don't usually ask that question until I know a kid well enough that I can sort of, from almost like a CBT sort of perspective, like challenge that thought. So I know them well enough, for example, that, you know, they're a great brother. They do all kinds of things for their siblings, or they're just like a strong connection with their sibling, or, you know, or they're really funny, or they're like, I know them well enough that I can help sort of, you know, challenge that. So it's almost like a lawyer, like you never ask a question that you don't know the answer to around that piece of it. Cause I would never want the kid to like leave worse than they felt coming in. But it's, that part is real work, really spending time on like appreciating themselves for who they are, seeing themselves for who they are, finding the good, finding the things that really make them wonderful. It takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And work. And it's like, it's, again, it's a challenging thought, because even if they come up with, and also I think helping them see the experience of that some of their process in growing up and seeing, for example, like I was treated so poorly, for example, so that means that I'm a total loser. And nobody really wanted to hang out with me, and everybody else wanted to hang out like over there, not with me. But that shift in understanding that, for example, that your friend didn't call you, and maybe there were things that made you different. For example, maybe you were more mature. Maybe you didn't want to push limits the way your friends did. Maybe you didn't want to, I mean, I think there's tremendous pressure right now around kids getting involved in things, even more so now, I think, because of social media, in that they're not ready to do. You know, so sexual activity or drug and alcohol activity, even earlier, even more pressure. I mean, I think we all felt that at some level when we were kids, but I think there's always been, I think, a bit of a, you know, there are some kids who are really ready when they're, for example, 13 or 14, and some kids who are so not ready for any of that are 13 and 14. But that pull is about, you know, fitting in. It's about, to me, it's about fitting in. So it's not necessarily about they don't like you. It's that they really like the shininess of this group over here, and they want to be included. And there's nothing more important when you're 13 or 14 than belonging. Mm. Frankly, that lasts for a really long time, that sense of belonging. And so people will, I used to meet with kids in my office and have a conversation with them and ask them questions about things, and they would have like these really strong morals and values about, you know, treating people with kindness, and I believe them. So maybe they were, you know, pulling one over on me, but I did believe that was ultimately in a one-on-one how they felt about things. And then they'd leave my office and I'd watch them in the halls, and they would treat someone like total crap in the hall. And I'd be like, how is it that you and I just had this conversation and now I'm watching your behavior? Because it's way more important for you to fit in than it is for you to sort of follow what you said to me in my office. And parents will talk about that too. How are they so different at home than they are? Well, at home they already belong, but out there they have to work at it. And so often, you know, their morals and values will be totally thrown out the window in order for them to have a sense of belonging. And sometimes when I talk about that with kids and they're like, oh my God, I never really thought about that. I thought that was totally about me. There was something wrong with me. It's not necessarily that there was anything wrong with you. It might be because those people were choosing to be with the shiny, forward-moving, fast-moving group than they were about, yeah, like you're quieter. Does that mean you're, like you're a horrible person? No, it doesn't. Like an introverted kid who's quieter, who isn't interested in the drugs and alcohol and fast-moving crowd might feel like they're left out of the faster-moving crowd that looks shinier, that like that just looks more appealing. And for some, that's more important.
You kind of depersonalize it a little bit and work with some of those negative beliefs. Yeah. And it, like, as you're talking, I'm just thinking of all the challenges for teenagers to be kind of whole, to follow their own values and morals. Like you said, this need to belong trumps so much. And really it's about safety, I guess, at the bottom of it. But there's so much working against self-esteem and confidence. And I guess you kind of brought up too the trauma piece and maybe having to do some trauma work with them to help them get past some of those barriers.
Mm-hmm. We also often will talk about sort of their involvement with social media.
Okay.
Because it feeds it. Right. So, you know, they'll say, but like, look at my friends. They're like having this amazing time at this. And then I inevitably, you know, we'll talk about all of these examples of in the news of people who like posted all of these amazing pictures of themselves before they committed horrible crimes, or I don't mean pictures of themselves with like weapons before they do it. I mean, like, you know, happy walking on the beach, you know, with their spouse hand in hand. And then you just, what is presented to you is not truth. And kids know that, I think, like on a cerebral level, but I think like in their hearts as they watch it and they see, you know, sort of what they think they're seeing. And then they look at themselves and like, and they think, well, why aren't I always happy like that? Why? Because that's not real. Mm-hmm. But to say to them, like, I often will say, what would it be like for you to not maybe like, what would it be like to not be on social media for a week? Oh my God, that's a crisis. Like, that's horrible. It's a terrible suggestion. But I floated out there just to even have them think about like, wow, that's a really strong response. But it often is the response that I get.
And do you think social media is tied into belonging?
Yeah, 100%, right? If I'm not on social media, then I don't belong. I don't have a presence. No one's going to know that I'm around. Nobody's going to see me.
I know for myself, like through this pandemic, I had to delete Facebook because I just, everyone has an opinion about something that, and it's just, you leave even after 5 minutes of scrolling, just feeling like crap half the time. And I think if, you know, luckily for us as adults and not growing up having social media, it's not as tied into belonging or connecting as it is for teenagers. So I think that's a really good point of how much they're tied to it and maybe how much it's impacting them mentally.
Yeah. I mean, I think even thinking about, well, I haven't returned this snap and it's like, oh, I left it unread. She's going to, and again, like that for me, that's a generation. If you've looked, I have no social media presence at all. I've got my business website and like, that's it. I'm not on Facebook. I don't post anything ever. I can certainly be sympathetic, but not really empathetic. I don't totally get that experience. I try really hard, but I think it's sympathy. It's not empathy. And I get it. Like I really get why it's so, so stressful for them. And I think if I could get rid of all of it, I would do it in a second. I just think it's put kids in such a difficult, difficult place. And I think validation, outward validation, has become so much more important than inner, right? Like really just seeing yourself for who you are and really liking that, is so much harder now because there's so much external, like, see me, how many posts, like how many likes am I going to get? How many views? You know, and when clients talk to me about, you know, I posted this and it's had a, like, you know, thousands of views, and the pride with which they speak about that, it's incredible. Wow. It's really, really, yeah. So
I'm always surprised by it too. And Snapchat and I'm not in that world, but you know, the fact that kids will talk to each other on Snapchat, but they've never actually talked in person and they're in the same class maybe. So it's, yeah. I mean, we could do a whole episode on social media, but it's changing the dynamics, relationships, the way we feel about ourselves. And it's so tied in with what you're saying with belonging. And so that's,
yeah, and how we,
sorry,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and how we help teenagers, you know, that's a huge barrier to confidence and self-esteem.
Yeah, and I think it also obviously impacts the way they literally communicate with each other. Like, I don't know, it's not like, and their Snapchats are like, they make the silliest faces, like, or like, you know, they take a picture of like the ceiling and they, why would your friend want to receive that? Like half of your nose and ceiling. I don't know. I don't get it. But yeah, then they're, you know, DMing, they're, you know, instant messaging each other. But then they don't know how to handle a problem, because like that's how they commute. Like, you're sending a picture of your nose is not going to solve the fact that you were really upset with your friend at school. Like, that's, it's not going to be addressed. So I think the more we model that for our kids at home as parents, the more we sort of, and that's where like the emotional piece comes in, like parents actually having emotional conversations with their kids where it's actually focused on the emotion part, and how they manage it and what you can do and how to sort of work through it. If they don't get that at home, they're literally not getting it anywhere. They're not getting it with their friends the way they used to, especially now, obviously during a pandemic where everything is online. And if you're lucky, you know, your kid is spending some time in a driveway or in a backyard with someone, but like, it's the lack of communication is crazy. And I do think I don't know if you're finding this, but I'm seeing regression, in kids because of this, especially with young adults. Just to go back to that piece, because, you know, normally a 19-year-old, many of them would be, you know, going to school or would be starting a trade or something. They would be doing something that is post high school. And many of them would be doing with a level of freedom, whether it's because they're living away at school or because they've been given more freedom because they're, you know, attending college downtown or whatever it is. But because the lack of freedom is sort of available, there's nowhere for them to go. They generally have to be at home. They regress, like, so they actually act younger, or they're not doing as much for themselves. And I think as parents, we kind of have to, again, we kind of have to validate that experience, and really look at it for what, like, it's real. It's a really real experience. Or like, I have, you know, 13-year-olds who are like, can I sleep with you, mom? Or 10-year-olds who are like, I need more cuddles. And they haven't had that, you know, or a bedtime story. Most 11-year-olds don't have bedtime stories, but they're craving it. And I think that's because they're just not doing what they normally do. Wow. Right? They're not seeing their friends. That focus of like belonging and needing peers, especially like from early teenage to late, it's not happening. And so it's scary.
Well, that's a really, that's a great point to help parents understand, and for them to maybe, going back to the expectations, you know, maybe recalibrating them a little bit, providing more support, being more emotionally connected and supportive. Yeah. Is there any resources that you are go-tos for you to give to parents around emotions and learning about emotions?
The EFFT script is a biggie. I use that a lot. But you can actually access that. Adela France actually just wrote a book, and the title of which is escaping me right at this second. But yeah, she basically uses the model in the book. I'm so sorry, I'm not remembering the title.
No, I put you on the spot here.
That's okay. But yeah, so her book I think is actually quite helpful.
And this is Adele LaFrance, who's created emotion-focused family therapy.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an offshoot of emotion-focused therapy. Is that accurate?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, correct. Yeah. So I use that for parents. I would actually say that's probably my number one, even though I can't remember the title. That actually is like my number one, I would say, for parents learning how to communicate with their kids, just in a really different way, because it really walks you through like the validation piece of it. I often like to use like videos and stuff like around empathy. Brené Brown, I often will use that little video with those two little animals because I think it explains a lot. I find parents are like, oh, okay, I get that. I like the little moose guy, I don't know, whatever he is, but yeah, so I find that helpful. What else do I use? Those I would say are sort of my biggies. It's funny. I also really like some of Jennifer Clary's stuff, Connected Parenting.
Okay.
I think that's also it's very similar. It's all sort of variation on a theme, but I like her. She's written a number of books, and I like what she talks about.
Yeah. I've actually been recommending some of my parents read children's books about emotions. Hmm. Even if they have teenagers, I think some of those books, Eleanor Greenwood has a book about big emotions. I forget exactly what it's called, but it really breaks it down on kind of like a 3 to 4 year old level about how emotions are adaptive and, you know, some of the primitive functions of them. And some parents are like, wow, like I'd really never learned any of this growing up. Yeah, I think the ones that you named are sound like great resources in it. And they kind of piggyback on your approach in therapy, which makes total sense to do that.
Yeah.
Well, I just have a couple kind of final questions that I like to ask everybody.
Sure.
So the first one is, in terms of, you know, there's a lot of new social workers, new therapists, new mental health workers that listen to the show. What do you do, techniques, strategies around preventing or mitigating or managing burnout and vicarious trauma?
I mean, everyone talks about self-care. I think everyone has to find really what works for them. And I think routine around that is really important. Like, I think just sort of putting it out there and being like, yeah, at some point I'm going to have to look after myself is not helpful. I think, first of all, really setting, you know, managing the financial piece of our work, which obviously is a huge factor. It is a job after all. I think many of us are very driven to be helpful as we can be. And so I even sort of was finding myself at the beginning like, oh, whatever, I'll see 7 in a day. It's fine. Like, you know, I don't want to put this person off. It's too long. If they have to wait an extra few days, I'll squeeze it in. Well, like 7 in my experience, 7 in a day is way too many. And so, you know, I think 5 is a really good number, but I think, you know, I often will slip into 6, but I have to recognize, like, if I'm doing 6 today, that means I'm only doing 4 tomorrow, because it's just too hard. And I think you have to pay attention to it. And so finding the balance between sort of what you need to do financially in order for you to pay the bills, and what you can do emotionally is really, really important. And I think you have to be really thoughtful about it. And I know different people have different sort of levels of energy. And so, you know, my 5 might be your 7. But I think you have to pay attention to that. And you really have to sort of lay down sort of the law with yourself around like, my limit is five, and so I'm doing five. And if I'm not going to do five, if I'm really going to not listen to myself, then at least I'm going to like give myself cushion. So if I'm going to see 7 3 days a week, then I'm going to take Friday off or whatever it is. But it's really about like making sure that you find that balance, in my opinion. One of the ways that I really make sure it's like, all right, well, oh no, I'm seeing six that day. That means like my limit today is four. And I really don't allow myself, you know, to push further. Pre-COVID times, I also was, you know, setting limits for myself around like what my start time was and what my end time was. I really wanted to make sure that I worked out every day, which was also part of my self-care. Like I found it remarkable how different I felt on the days that I didn't fit in a work in, but work out in. So I just made that part of my routine. It's like, and if that means I'm starting later, because that allows me to not have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to work out, and I can work out at 7 or whatever, then that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to just start my day later. And if that means clients are unhappy that I don't have a, you know, an 8 o'clock available, I'm sorry to my clients, but I'm better off for you as a therapist if I'm starting later, because I've looked after myself that day. So I think you have to just work it into your, it has to be part of your routine is what I would recommend.
I like that you talk about number of sessions. I think that's really important. And I don't know about you, but I feel like doing video and phone sessions, like two video sessions to me is equivalent energy wise to four in-person sessions. Totally. It's draining. Totally.
Yeah, it's a really, it's a different ball game altogether. So it's the same thing. I've just sort of had to adapt and been like, all right, I'm only doing this many sessions in a day. And if that means people have to wait, it's okay. And also just like at the end of the day, getting an, like I don't do, you know, sort of email therapy, but often I'll get a client who will be like, this happened, how do I handle this? And I'm just like, let's talk about this when I see you next. But that was really hard for me. to just set that limit, like we'll talk about this another time, but when I see you, or we can set up a phone conversation if you want, I'm happy to talk to you about it, but I'm it's 9 o'clock and I'm done for the day, so I'm actually just not going to respond to this email until tomorrow, and that's okay. But it was hard for me to get my head around that piece of it. I want to be helpful. Like, okay, I'll be helpful in the morning. Yeah.
No, that's great advice. And so lastly, do you have any wisdom outside? I know we've talked about so much today and I really appreciate everything that you've shared. Do you have any wisdom or tips for new therapists, new social workers, new counselors?
Don't do it alone, I would say. So whether it's, you know, surround yourself with colleagues, who are doing what you're doing, even if it's, you know, once a month or once every 6 weeks or whatever, but just make sure it can be quite a lonely, it was one of the biggest things I sort of noticed in moving out of the school where I was, you know, supervising like 50 people who I was talking to all the time, and working with hundreds of kids, to really just being on my own, and not, you know, not being able to walk into someone else's office and vent about something that just happened that was really upsetting or whatever. It's like, I got no one, I'm on my own. So, I found really quickly that I needed to find, a way to have support around that. So I've created little groups of people that I meet up with every once in a while. And we just sort of talk about issues and talk about what our experiences are. And I have a supervisor that I speak to on a regular basis. And that's really, really helpful too. So I feel like even, you know, in being someone who's been doing counseling for a really long time and therapy for shorter, for sure. But, you know, I'm not new, I wouldn't say. And I'm still seeking supervision regularly. I just completed the supervision course. I'm now a supervisor. I'm also supervising other people, but I'm still in supervision.
Yeah. This is so never ending.
I would say, get yourself a supervisor that you really like working with. Mm-hmm. And stick with it. Cause I think it's really, really helpful.
That's great wisdom. I love it. So so you're in Toronto, and if people want to reach out to you, want to find out more about you or connect with you, what's the best way to do that?
Probably going to my website if they wanted more information, dEpsteinTherapy.com, or emailing me if they had questions.
Yeah, because we're not going to find you on Instagram, I guess. And
no, you're not. No, you're not. That just never spoke to me. I don't know. It just, I don't get it. Yeah. Again, it generates that, but I don't get it. It's just not a jam. So the website is probably the best way to get information about me.
A good old email and website connection.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, old school. Yeah. Relatively. Well, yeah, but thanks for asking.
Yeah. No. Oh, it's been so good to talk to you, Deborah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.